Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest. Now, we're glad to be with you with honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. I want to give you a heads up that in about the next 30 minutes, President Trump is said to be planning a major announcement of some kind. We'll drop in on that as the occasion happens. But there is a lot to talk about, and I wanted to start with the thing that has really gotten under my skin so far today, and that is John Kitzhaber. Remember John Kitzhaber, the disgraced and former governor of the state of Oregon, who has cut a deal. He cut a deal because he was forced to resign from his office only a month after he was inaugurated. And this happened back in 2015. It's been a couple of years, 2.5 years now. And the reason he had to quit is because he had a shady deal going on with his girlfriend, Sylvia Hayes, who he had allowed to operate a for-profit consulting business directly out of the governor's office. And you might remember that just a few weeks before he finally resigned from office, he held a news conference. I went to it. I don't attend a lot of news conferences, but this one happened to be at a time when I could get there and ask him a few questions. And he stood right there in front of a room full of reporters just weeks before he would hand in his resignation. And he said that he had done everything he could to try to keep his girlfriend's private consulting business separate from what he was doing as governor of the state. Well, the question is whether or not Sylvia Hayes was allowed to earn literally hundreds of thousands of dollars for consulting work for private organizations that wanted to influence the governor. And what better way to influence a 70-year-old governor than by getting his 50-year-old girlfriend to tell him where his positions ought to be on one issue or another? So today, we found out just a couple of hours ago, John Kitzhaber has now confessed that he violated state ethics laws. And he has a settlement with the State Ethics Commission. And get this. His girlfriend makes a couple of hundred thousand dollars. He creates a massive problem in Oregon government. He has to be replaced just a month after he's sworn into office. And what does he pay for all that? He's going to pay a big fine of $1,000. That's it. And this is the part that gets even crazier. According to the final order that the commission will vote on Friday, Kitzhaber had a potential conflict of interest from 2011 through 2013, 2 years in which he made policy decisions and public appearances in his official capacity as the governor of Oregon, where those policies and appearances overlapped with the issues for which 3E Strategies, that's Sylvia Hayes' private company, was receiving payment for its advocacy, writing, and speaking, and that Kitzhaber should have publicly announced those conflicts. Dr. Kitzhaber was met with potential conflicts because his policy decisions and public appearances could have resulted in a financial benefit or a detriment to 3R Strategies. Now, this is the biggest bunch of baloney I've seen in my life. This guy allowed his girlfriend to act as First Lady of Oregon. He told his staff that they would do work for her. Remember, these are taxpayer-funded employees. They did everything from arrange her travel, literally, to emptying her cat box at the house where she lived with the governor in Mahonia Hall. So he had them doing the grunt work and the scut work for this woman. He also insisted that she be included in most of the public policy meetings as though she was a staff member of the governor, even though her private business was a pure conflict. But this is the best part. According to the settlement that the Ethics Commission reached with Kitzhaber, the former governor did not know that the goal of Sylvia Hayes' paid work was to shape government policy. Now, that is, I understand they're going to sign off on this Friday. He'll pay the $1,000 and all will be forgiven. That is a lie. John Kitzhaber knew exactly what his girlfriend was consulting on. The companies that she did business with, a lot of them were private nonprofits like Demos that wrote large checks, 5- and 6-figure checks for her to do work for them. tens of thousands, and in even case, one case, more than $100,000 paid to her to influence the governor's position on coal, on energy, on the environment, on carbon dioxide, on all those things. And John Kitzhaber would have you believe that he had no idea, none at all, that what she was doing. In fact, here's the best part. Kitzhaber says the work for her nonprofit organizations was not directed at trying to shape or influence public policy, according to Kitzhaber, but rather to be an educator and a storyteller in those areas to which she had committed her professional career. You know, I'll bet there were some great bedtime stories that were told by Sylvia Hayes to John Kitzhaber about the work she was doing. Because before he hooked up with her and she hooked up with him, she had a little teeny consulting company. Let me give you an idea. One of the jobs she did before she became the governor's girlfriend and started cashing in on that connection, the way she'd cashed in on the marrying the illegal alien, the Ethiopian, so he could get citizenship and a permanent green card. She got $5,000 for that. Before she got involved with Kitzhaber, she was involved with another guy in an illegal marijuana farm. Before all that, she gets together. Before she got together with the governor, one of the big jobs that 3E Strategies had was consulting with the city of Bend about the kind of light bulbs they would have in the parks in the city. So they were doing energy. She was doing energy consulting. We're talking about little teeny tiny chippy contracts like that. And all of a sudden, she becomes the governor's girlfriend, and she is running through a couple of $100,000 worth of consulting fees paid to her by private companies. And the governor was such a clueless old man with a young girlfriend that he had no idea whatsoever that people were paying her big money because she had his ear. He had no clue. We should all be very thankful that John Kitzhaber is no longer governor, because a guy that clueless, I don't think he could run anything. He'd have a tough time running a popsicle stand if he really, truly is that clueless. But if you believe that he's that clueless, you believe that lie from the Ethics Commission, we're going to have corruption here in the Pacific Northwest for a long, long time, as long as the very folks who guard this stuff are saying John Kitzhaber can tell them lies like that and get out of all that trouble and make all that money, because remember, it flowed into their accounts. They live together. They share expenses together. At one point, when Sylvia Hayes was told she could no longer do this kind of consulting work, this was as they were beginning to get into trouble, she wrote an email to John Kitzhaber that became public that said she needed $60,000 a year just to pay her individual bills, and they were sharing expenses, so whatever money flowed to Sylvia Hayes, I would say effectively flowed to John Kitzhaber as well. Kind of nice to be able to pull down a couple of $100,000 in peddled influence and only have to pay a $1,000 fine and get people to believe the lie that you had no idea what was going on. If anybody believes that and you're a naysayer, I'd be glad to entertain your argument. And in the meantime, we'll get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish wrapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, the official story of Judge Roy Moore, Senate candidate in Alabama, keeps on changing. That means the Republican Party should change its stance on Moore. Last week, the very liberal Washington Post breaks a story accusing Moore of dating and even assaulting teenage girls almost 40 years ago. Who knows if it's true? Well, Roy Moore, for one. I've asked Judge Moore for interviews for most of this year, and he hasn't been willing to come on. But this week, he made it a lot easier for all of us by confirming the story in this way. In a very friendly interview with Fox News anchor Sean Hannity, Moore was asked about who he dated in his 30s. He responded that he always asked the mothers of the girls. Now, a guy in his 30s shouldn't be dating high school girls, and adult women don't need their mother's permission to date. He refused to directly answer, "Did you date teenage girls?" If Moore is uncomfortable with the truth, we should be as well. So Moore has as good as admitted that the WAPO story is at least in some ways accurate. The best scenario, as far as I'm concerned, Moore wins ends, the Senate refuses to seat him. Alabama's governor reappoints Jeff Sessions to his old seat. Trump nominates a new attorney general, and Hillary goes to jail.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
Today's Daily Grill, I'm going to award it to a county hearings examiner who's denied two permits that Millennium Bulk Terminals need for its two-thirds of a billion-dollar coal export terminal project on the Columbia River. That project would have brought a lot of jobs and a lot of income and a lot of tax revenue, and instead, we're going to watch it slowly be killed in the oh-so-blue state of Washington. Mike Edson writes in with today's best email, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Lars, sorry to write so late on this. It's amazing how these guys could find an excuse for this to happen. A person in, say, their 30s has learned a lot about life, I hope. An older person might know how to groom a young person and how to talk or set up a situation to take advantage of a young person. Not caring about the future of the person being used, that is a predator, a rapist, a power move. How about those guys, or how those guys could in any way defend such activity is beyond me. I think they were jealous. If it would have happened to my daughter, the outcome would have been very, very different. Signed, Mike. To your emails and your phone calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Well, I don't think there's a better example of government gone wild than what the Washington State Supreme Court has just announced today. If you're not familiar with the McCleary decision, here's how the McCleary decision works. There is a constitutional requirement to adequately fund schools. Sounds good. Until you turn it over to the Washington Supreme Court, which gets an amazing number of donations from the teachers' unions. And they decide every single year, no, whatever you've put up, even billions of dollars of additional funding for schools, it is nowhere near enough. Pay more. Well, they have just done this again, and this is even though the Washington State Legislature, I thought, had really gone to the mat and said, we're going to fund education. Now, I don't want education to be run by the Supreme Court. I want education to be run by the state legislature and by the governor to some extent, but mostly by local school boards and local communities. But that's not what's happening. So here's the story today out of Olympia. The Washington State Supreme Court announced today it will keep its contempt order and daily sanctions in place, that's $100,000 a day in punishment, against the state in its McCleary K-12 school funding order. In a unanimous order, the justices acknowledged that the state has made significant progress in fully funding the program of basic education, but the school funding program, approved by lawmakers this year, delays by over a year implementation of a constitutionally compliant salary model, a critical part. In other words, all you taxpayers are not paying nearly enough. The legislature has not come up with enough money. The justices announced that they will continue overseeing the case, and they ordered the state to report on its progress in April after the 2018 legislative session is expected to end. In other words, justices that are getting campaign donations in large amounts from the teachers' unions are saying, whatever it is that you're paying, it is not nearly enough. You have to pay more. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today about the Kitzhaber stuff I just mentioned, is a $1,000 fine sufficient punishment for John Kitzhaber's crimes? Now, I'm using the term crime generically. He's not indicted on a formal offense. I think he committed crimes against the state of Oregon, generically. I think that being governor and selling out the citizenry for your girlfriend's business, I think that's awful. It is criminal to do that, generically criminal. I think he should be punished with something more than a $1,000 fine. I mean, after all, if you tell everybody in government that if you can go out and peddle influence through your girlfriend and make a couple of $100,000 and pay a $1,000 fine, the whole point of fines is to make sure people don't do it again.
That's what a parking fine is for. It's what a speeding ticket is for. And yet in this case, the fine that John Kitzhaber is going to pay is absolutely nothing. It's de minimis, to use a lawyer term. And on top of that, to believe this lie that, oh, Governor Kitzhaber had no idea that his girlfriend's business was anything more than being a really clever storyteller. That her, the idea that her job was to somehow change John Kitzhaber's mind about anything or influence the outcome of public policies. Let me tell you something. The kinds of policies that Oregon government has adopted under John Kitzhaber are tremendously damaging to businesses, to individuals, to people's ability to pay their utility bills. It's very damaging when the cost of energy goes up, the number of jobs you have goes down, all because the state says, well, we have to have these policies. We've got to have wind and we've got to have solar, and we've got to get rid of that really inexpensive power that we now get from coal, and we've got to generate it with some other means. We've got to have subsidized solar and subsidized electric cars and all that. All of that damaging to average citizens, and for some reason, they let him get away with it. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll found two places, online at LarsLarson.com and on Twitter at Lars Larson Show, is brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, gravel, sand, and topsoil. Let the Dan Jones trucks put it where you want it and save your aching back. While you're on the website, visit my trophy room at LarsLarson.com, powered by Northwest Armory. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventure and have the chance to win some great prizes. If you want to take part in honestly provocative talk radio, it's right here every day on the Radio Northwest Network at 866-439-5277, or you can always send emails directly to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I told you that President Trump was going to make a few comments, and he is, from the White House about his Asia trip. Let's take a listen and see what he's got to say.
Thank you very much. Last night, I returned from a historic 12-day trip to Asia. This journey took us to five nations to meet with dozens of foreign leaders, participate in three formal state visits, and attend three key regional summits. It was the longest visit to the region by an American president in more than a quarter of a century. Everywhere we went, our foreign hosts greeted the American delegation, myself included, with incredible warmth, hospitality, and most importantly, respect. And this great respect showed very well our country is further evidence that America's renewed confidence and standing in the world has never been stronger than it is right now. When we are confident in ourselves, our strength, our flag, our history, our values, other nations are confident in us. And when we treat our citizens with the respect they deserve, other countries treat America with the respect that our country so richly deserves. During our travels, this is exactly what the world saw: a strong, proud, and confident America. Today, I want to update the American people on the tremendous success of this trip and the progress we've made to advance American security and prosperity throughout the year. When I came into office, our country was faced with a series of growing dangers. These threats included rogue regimes pursuing deadly weapons, foreign powers challenging America's influence, the spread of the murderous terror group ISIS, and years of unfair trade practices that had dangerously depleted our manufacturing base and wiped out millions and millions of middle-class jobs. The challenges were inherited, and these products really showed what previous mistakes were made over many years and even decades by other administrations. Some of these mistakes were born of indifference and neglect, others from naive thinking and misguided judgment. In some cases, the negative influence of partisan politics and special interests was to blame. But the one common thread behind all of these problems was a failure to protect and promote the interests of the American people and American workers. Upon my inauguration, I pledged that we would rebuild America, restore its economic strength, and defend its national security. With this goal in mind, I vowed that we would reaffirm old alliances and form new friendships in pursuit of shared goals. Above all, I swore that in every decision, with every action, I would put the best interests of the American people first. Over the past 10 months, traveling across the globe and meeting with world leaders, that is exactly what I have done.
Donald Trump speaking live from the White House at the end of his 12-day Asia trip, one of the longest trips by an American president to that part of the world. We'll take a look at some of the other things the president has had to say today. On the phone with me right now is the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer from Willamette Week, Nigel Jaques, who's come up with one heck of a story here in the Pacific Northwest. Nigel, thank you very much for agreeing to join us today. How are you?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm fine, Lars. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about this story involving two very affluent, very, socially connected people, John Bradley and his wife, or then-wife, Kim Bradley, and about the horror story that you were told by Kim Bradley about what happened in that relationship over a 30-year period.
Sure. 2 years ago, I wrote a story about John Bradley being arrested for domestic violence. He was then the majority owner and CEO of R&H Construction, a large construction firm here in Portland. At the time and later, people suggested that it was a one-off incident, that he'd been drinking and lost control, and that it, you know, was not part of a pattern. And over the past 2 years, the Bradleys have gone through, they're nearly finished with a pretty messy divorce, and I had been interested to learn more about that and the relationship and what had preceded the incident of 2 years ago. And I had the opportunity to review a massive, you know, amount of court documents and interview Kim Bradley. And what she described to me was more than 30-year pattern of emotional and mental abuse. And the last decade of it was also physical abuse. And so that's the story that we have today.
And the story really gets into, and you explore this in a couple of ways, and I know Rachel Monahan also wrote a story to go along with it, about why it's so hard for women to leave these kinds of relationships, because you might imagine that this happens where there's a very low-income couple somewhere, and both of them are up against the wall financially. But this was a couple that routinely gave, what, $100,000 a year to charity. They lived in a nice house. He had a nice job. They were comfortable financially, but this is a woman who didn't feel that she could leave that relationship, and why?
Yeah, I really learned a lot through my reporting. I think the question that I asked is a question a lot of people ask, which is, why didn't you leave? And she and many experts and prosecutors explained to me that that's a victim-blaming question. And she described to me a situation where, you know, she was afraid to leave. She was afraid the violence would get worse if she left, and actually, studies have shown that a lot of the homicides that are part of domestic violence take place when the victim actually does leave. That often triggers the greatest level of violence. The other factors, of course, they have a family, they have children, they have a home together, they have a position in the community, they have lots of things, as you pointed to, but there's also these common patterns of behavior. He would lose his temper, then he would apologize. He would promise never to do it again. He would promise that he would, you know, seek help, that he would get treatment, help himself be a better person. And I think anybody who's in a long-term relationship will know that it's hard not to respond to that. But, you know, what you get from the story, I think, is just the idea of how incredibly unpleasant it can be to be locked into a long-term pattern of abuse. And to your earlier point that they have a lot of resources, they're certainly multimillionaires. The thing that we learn about domestic abuse is that it knows no economic boundaries. You know, there's a lot of economic privilege in that relationship, but she still couldn't get out.
No, and in fact, she literally would hide in the attic or the laundry chute. She was so fearful of being...
She would hide under the dining room table in the laundry chute. She would lock herself in her closet. She regularly left the home and hid. She showed me some of the hiding places. There's an abandoned garage in their neighborhood. She hid on neighbors' porches. There's a community center in the Northwest Hills, the Hillside Community Center, and she found a little place in the bushes there that she could go and hide and nobody could see her. So it's kind of remarkable if you think about a woman of her means, her position in the community, sneaking around in the dark, finding places that she could be safe from her husband. It's sort of a horrific image.
And all of this with the idea in mind that if she stepped out of line, she would face both verbal and physical wrath from her husband.
Yeah, she showed me photos of a number of occasions on which he left marks on either her neck or her arms. She described a number of occasions in which she had to seek medical treatment. He outweighed her by 60 pounds. It's a common scenario. You know, men are just genetically larger and stronger than women are, and she described him, you know, regularly erupting for no discernible reason, and her just sort of, you know, living every day on eggshells and never knowing when he was going to lose it.
Well, unless people think, well, this is just her imagination or this is her version of the story, ever since there was a no-contact order issued by a judge. So a judge said, don't have any contact. John Bradley's been arrested twice and put in jail twice for violating that. And this is a substantial person within the community who runs and owns or did run and own a big construction company. So he was in a position to, you know, where you'd think he'd know better. But even with a judge telling him not to do it, he still would have contact with her, right?
Yeah, that's right. He was arrested and jailed twice. And I think, you know, we can all imagine that if you've been married to somebody for decades, the emotional ties, the desire to communicate with them, the desire to be near them could be very strong. But, yeah, she had a no-contact order and then a stronger court order, a restraining order, and they weren't enough to dissuade him. And, you know, frankly, a guy in his position does not often get arrested, does not often spend a night in jail. So for him to do that sort of shows how strong his desire to be in communication with her is, and that scares her.
You can read the whole story at WWeek.com. Its author is the Pulitzer Prize winner, Nigel Jaquess. Nigel, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me on, Lars.
You bet. Nigel Jaquess with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Donald Trump is still speaking from the White House about his trip to Asia.
With China, and for our trading relationship to be conducted on a truly fair an equitable basis.
See, I like the way
we can no longer tolerate unfair trading practices that steal American jobs, wealth, and intellectual property. The days of the United States being taken advantage of are over.
See, and I love that. And people say, well, this is strange. It's not strange. The president comes out and criticizes China, says they're taking advantage of us. Then he goes over there and says to them, I understand why you're doing this. You're trying to do this to advantage your own people. And that's certainly understandable, but you're not going to do it anymore. Now, do you understand what he's doing? He can be a good cop and he can be a bad cop at the same time. And he can tell China, you've gotten away with this for a long time and you're not going to get away with it anymore. I know why you did it. You did it for your people. I'm going to do the same thing for my people. We're going to have an equitable trading arrangement or not at all. Brian's on the line in Spanaway, Washington. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. What's on your mind today?
Well, I noticed a few days ago something is not being addressed, and I was kind of curious as to why.
About which issue?
About the whole Roy Moore situation and the 17 and the 14 and all that.
Yeah.
And the issue that I noticed missing is that the age of consent, I believe now, is still 16 years old.
And I don't think it matters one little bit. And, in fact, we have addressed it almost every single day that this has come up. And the reason it doesn't matter, go ahead.
No, I haven't heard your show in a while, so okay. I didn't know that.
That's all right. Well, the reason I think it doesn't matter is this. If Roy, it seems at this point that Judge Moore has all but admitted that he did date teenage girls in his 30s. Now, but the fact that he won't say it outright tells me that he's uncomfortable with the subject, right? And right. Anytime you're uncomfortable with a subject, you won't address it directly. So if I go out some night and I have a few too many whiskeys, and somebody asks me about it the next day, and I say, yeah, I probably had more than I should have had. Do I say I was falling on my face drunk? Well, if I'm honest about it, maybe I should be honest about the way I'm describing it. He has said he won't say he didn't date teenagers in his 30s. And then you get to the question of, well, is that legal? It doesn't matter if it's legal. What matters is if you did do that and that showed that you had what I would call an unhealthy interest in teenage girls in your 30s, should you be a U.S. senator? Ultimately, that's a decision for the voters. But the very fact that Roy Moore doesn't want to address it directly tells me that he's uncomfortable with it. And if he's uncomfortable with it, should we be, Brian?
Yeah, I would say so, because, I mean, if I had a daughter that age, I wouldn't want some creepy old guy hanging around.
Yeah.
So, okay.
And that's the way I look at it. So the fact that you have the right to do it does not mean it's the right thing to do. There are lots of things that are legal to do. I mean, you can go out and get so stinking drunk that you puke on your own shoes. But if you do it in front of your boss, it's not going to do you any good at raise time. In fact, it may send you out the door with a pink slip. That young lady who got on the bicycle and flipped off the president's motorcade, and there was a picture of her, and she put it up on her Facebook page, and it got her fired. Why? Is it illegal to flip off the president of the United States? No, it's actually constitutionally protected. But if you do it, do you expect to keep your job? Probably not. So there's a difference between right to do and whether or not something is right to do, right?
Yep, no problem with that.
So I'm curious what the people of Alabama will do with this, and I don't think this is going to poll accurately. The election is coming up on the 12th of next month, so we're less than a month away, and I think it's going to be tough to do a poll that actually shows whether people are actually going to vote for him or not. I imagine there are a lot of people in Alabama who won't say out loud that they don't want to support Judge Moore. He's a very popular figure in that state, despite the controversies he's been involved with over the decades. And I admire him for some of his stances. His stances on the Ten Commandments are absolutely legendary, and they're absolutely admirable. But if people say, do you have or did you have an unhealthy interest in teenage girls sexually, and you can't talk about it, but you won't say you didn't, then you're putting yourself in a really tough spot. And not quite as bad as Harvey Weinstein or Anthony Weiner or one of those, but pretty bad all the way around. So I appreciate the call, Brian. Thanks a lot for listening. Glad to have your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, a former advisor to President Donald Trump and now national security strategist for Fox News. Dr. Gorka, good to have you back on the program.
Great to be back, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I want to know something. You are national security strategist for Fox News, and you and I have talked about Uranium One and the deal that was signed off on so that the Russians have access to, or they have control of, 20% of America's uranium reserves. It doesn't mean that they actually got the uranium, but they control where it goes and who it's sold to and all that. And we understand that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, had to sign off on that deal. And a lot of us think this ought to be investigated. One of your colleagues at Fox News, Shepard Smith, apparently went off this week, off the reservation, as it were, because I think he comes from he's cut from a different political cloth, if you will. He decided to go off on this whole thing and say that he is going to debunk the whole idea of Hillary Clinton being involved in the Uranium One deal and that that's any kind of controversy at all. I wanted to get your take on that.
I didn't see what Shep said, but the facts of the case are incontrovertible. Not only was she involved in that decision, it's called the CFIUS Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S., she was the chairman of the committee, ex officio, as the Secretary of State. She had to approve that. as did other members of the Obama administration. And every single aspect of that decision is blatantly a pay-for-play scandal. Her foundation received more than $140 million as this deal was going through. Her husband received $500,000 in speaking fees from the same commercial interest interested in the deal. And we now know the FBI was investigating corruption, bribery, all kinds of Russian illegal felonious activity occurring on U.S. soil in connection with that acquisition. So I don't know what talking points Shep is using, but the facts are incontrovertible. And Sean Hannity last night listed them majestically in the second segment of his program.
See, I think what Shep was trying to say was, well, there's this 9-member committee. The problem is, as I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Doc, with her vote, that deal could go through. Without her vote, it could not. She was the linchpin to that deal either happening or not happening, which is what gave her vote such great commercial value to the Russians.
Correct. Her being the chairman of the CFIUS committee meant that she was in the pole position to guarantee that that acquisition went through. The deal should not have gone through at all, but Hillary made it possible.
Now, do you believe that we're going to see a full and thorough investigation of Hillary Clinton's connection to this Uranium One deal? And should either Jeff Sessions, or if he ends up back in his old Senate seat, which sounds like it might at least be possible given the circumstances in Alabama right now, should the DOJ open a full-scale investigation of the Uranium One deal?
If you read between the lines of the AG's testimony yesterday on the Hill, I think it's pretty clear that movement finally has occurred and that some form of investigation is already occurring. So I'm not a fan of special counsels or special prosecutors. They usually end up investigating things that had nothing to do with the original mandate. But DOJ, FBI, they have more than adequate remit to investigate all of the scandals, whether it's Uranium One, whether it's the dodgy dossier, or whether it's the email scandal with regards to secret information Hillary had put on a private server. They have the authority, and it looks like something is finally happening.
Well, you actually made a comparison between the Hillary Clinton Uranium One Russia deal and the Rosenbergs from the 1950s.
I did. I know it made liberal heads explode, but I did it again just yesterday. The Rosenbergs received a death sentence because of their selling of nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union as key traitors during the beginnings of the Cold War. With the Uranium One deal, it wasn't know-how. It wasn't technological secrets that were given away. It was actual uranium. It was strategic asset, which is used not only for medical isotopes, not only to treat cancer, but to make nuclear weapons. That's the enormity of this scandal.
Now, at the end of the day, if we get an investigation of this, what do you think is the most that Hillary and Bill Clinton might be expected to get? I mean, let's be realistic about where this is going to go, because I don't know whether I can be optimistic enough, Dr. Gorka, to expect that Hillary Clinton might actually be held to the full extent of the law.
I am a mug's game. I'm not going to get into crystal ball gazing, but I will say the question is the following. And I actually tweeted this out, I think, yesterday. There's one question right now, and that question is, are the Clintons, this criminal cartel, are they above the law? Is America a nation of rule of law, of justice? Is it a nation where if you have the right last name, you are immune from the scales of justice? Those are the stakes of the matter at hand. Are they above the law, or will we be a nation of laws?
Let me ask you this. What's your evaluation of the president's Asia trip and what we got or didn't get out of that?
Stunning. It doesn't matter which trip you're talking about, whether you were talking about his trip to the Middle East, his trip to Europe, or the Asia trip. I mean, think about, just one metric. when President Obama went there as part of his apology tour, his 8-year apology tour for America, the Chinese didn't even send the stairs to Air Force One. He had to exit from the back and didn't even get a red carpet. The president was received in the Forbidden City by Xi Jinping. The president was listened to the China military play the national anthem of our great nation in the capital of Beijing. So you tell me whether American leadership and communist countries like China understand that there's a new sheriff in town.
I'm talking to Dr. Sebastian Gorka, the national security strategist for Fox News and former advisor to President Trump. We'll see. Doc, that's the part I'm most impressed with, is that Donald Trump has, as a candidate and as president, rhetorically beaten the daylights out of the Chinese. I mean, he has beat them up six ways from Sunday. And then he shows up and they treat him like a bigger rock star than any other, president to have visited before. The first, foreign leader to go to the Forbidden City for dinner in 68 years. And so they treat him like a rock star. And he says, I know why you did what you did with your trade deals, but you did it for your people and I'm going to do it for my people. And we're not going to have that relationship anymore. And the Chinese seem, they weren't exactly going to roll over and play dead for him, but it seemed as though all of his harsh words for them were also coupled with a message, kind of like a Teddy Roosevelt message, speak softly and carry a big stick, except that Donald Trump tends to speak extemporaneously and carries a big stick as well.
Yes, sir. Tweet softly and carry a stick.
Well, he seems to be doing a great job for Americans.
Look, strength garners respect.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know. And the Chinese get it.
I think Americans get it as well. It's only politicians that don't. Dr. Gorka, congratulations on your spot at Fox News as national security strategist, and we always appreciate your time. Now, we may have lost our connection with him. Dr. Sebastian Gorka, former presidential advisor to Donald Trump. We'll be back in just a moment. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails. Let's get back to those. I know we spent a lot on interviews today. Let me go, first of all, to Ron in Tacoma, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI, part of our Radio Northwest Network. Ron, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I was the caller that called yesterday to inform you that Mr. Moore was a Democrat when all this occurred. Remember
and,
that?
And you are correct. About 25 or 30 years ago, he was a Democrat, but none of which matters, does it?
Well, it kind of does matter, and I understand the context of what you're asking that question. However, there's another inconvenient truth here. I just found out this morning that allegedly where this crime occurred, in the back parking area of this restaurant, there is no back parking area of this restaurant. So there's all kinds of little inconvenient truths popping up.
Okay. Can I throw one back at you? Because this is what I try to solve most of the issues where there's something like this. I look at them logically. So here's the logical contradiction we've got. No matter what has been said about him that has generated the start of this conversation, here's where it could have ended. If they had said to Judge Moore, in your 30s, did you date or try to date anybody in their teens? Now, as I said in the show earlier today, I could tell you honestly that in my late teens, when I was 19, I had a high school girlfriend, and we were still, boyfriend and girlfriend, and she was still in school because she was a year behind me. So I was 19 and she was 18. But I could tell you honestly, I didn't have a single date with anybody in my 20s who was a teenager. And I didn't have a single date with anybody in my 30s who was a teenager, nor in my 40s. Judge Moore was asked that exact question. So no matter what was said by the accusers about what happened, where and when 40 years ago, the question should have been easy for the judge to answer. Either he dated teenage girls when he was in his 30s, or he didn't. One way or the other. What he did was he gave a down-the-middle answer, which said, that wouldn't have been my general practice. And you think, well, hold on, that means you did have some people you dated who were teenagers when you were in your 30s. That alone would probably disqualify most politicians today, whether it's legal or not. if you talk to a 30-year-old, a 30 or a 40-year-old today, and you say, when you were in your early 30s, did you date some high school girls? And he says yes, I guarantee you he's not going to do very well at the polls, period. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And I'm with you on that. If he did do what they're saying, that's a problem. My only concern is, the answer is not letting the Democrat in there. And I got to tell you, what really concerns me the most is I was one of these voters that wanted the status quo change. The only reason that I stayed with the Republican Party, because I was fierce with them after the last 8 years, I was ready to pull the switch for Democrats. Figured if they're just going to let these people destroy the country anyway, I might as well just let Democrats do it. Because one thing you can count on, they'll get the job done. And I'm not going to sit back and vote for Republicans anymore. Like, let's put it this way. I think Sessions needs to recuse himself from the position he's in. He needs to go back. Because if he stays, it's looking like I'm just going to have to just continue on with the original voting of Democrats. It looks to me that nothing, I can't. I'm basically like you, Lars. I'm a person that believes in the law, and I can't sit back anymore and let the Republicans screw this up.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. And Ron, yeah. think about how frustrated I am, because Jeff Sessions is Attorney General, and I have always thought the world of that guy, and he has deeply disappointed me. And I don't understand why he isn't doing the things that you would think he would automatically do as the nation's chief law enforcement officer, that he would be bringing cases against, Hillary and Bill and a whole bunch of other things, including, I would think, some charges against people who ran the IRS when it was used as a political tool by Barack Obama, and people who shipped guns into Mexico through Fast and Furious and were implicated in, the killings of Americans. I'm with you. I'm very frustrated by this. But on the other hand, what do we do when we have a guy who has this in his background? Do we say, well, if he's got an R in front of his name, doesn't matter what he did? Well, we're adopting a really terrible standard then at that point. And again, for a lot of people, Ron, I keep hearing from people going, but it was technically legal, Well, it doesn't matter if it was technically legal. There are lots of things that are technically legal that are still fatal to you if you're running for office, especially under the banner of Republican. I mean, chasing skirts, that worked very well for Bill Clinton. Nobody on the Democrat side seemed to have a problem with it. And Anthony Weiner only got in trouble because it finally became public that he was sending private pictures of his privates to co-eds on the West Coast that he didn't even know when he was married to a woman and had a baby on the way. I mean, for Democrats, it's probably a badge of honor to engage in that kind of sleazy behavior. But for Republicans, no, we can't do this. So what's the best outcome? I don't know if you heard the commentary I did earlier, and I'm not saying I'm brilliant or anything, but here's my best outcome for what happens, okay? I put this in the commentary earlier today when I started the show. I said, best outcome, Roy Moore wins the election. The Senate refuses to seat him. The governor of Alabama says if they won't seat Roy Moore in the Senate, I will reappoint Jeff Sessions to be the senator from the great state of Alabama, and Sessions will jump out of the AG's job, allowing Donald Trump to appoint somebody else, because clearly the president is very frustrated with Jeff Sessions in that job, or at least he has been within the last couple of months, so much so that he publicly lambasted Jeff Sessions, so he can put Trey Gowdy in there, put some hardcore former prosecutor in there who will do what apparently Jeff Sessions won't do, even though I'll reserve the fact that I like the guy. I think the guy's been a quality guy for a long, long time. And for the life of me, I don't understand why he's not doing the things you'd think he would do as AG. Now, would that work out well for you? We still get to keep the seat.
You betcha.
Okay, so, and by the way, the last capper of that is, after you put Jeff Sessions back in his seat, after you appoint a new attorney general, then Hillary Clinton goes to jail, and that's the end of the story. How do you like that one?
That sounds like a winner, Lars.
And we all lived happily ever after. Thank you very much, Ron. I appreciate the call. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And We have so much to talk about today, including our quick poll question, which you can find at LarsLarson.com and on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. Is a $1,000 fine sufficient punishment for John Kitzhaber's crimes? Today, the deal was announced that the former governor of Oregon, who resigned his post 2 years ago because he and his girlfriend had engaged in essentially a pay-for-play arrangement. She made a lot of money. He put her in the position to do it. She ran her private business out of the governor's office. He pays just $1,000 and claims he didn't know anything was going on. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. But before we go back to your calls, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the District Attorney of Clackamas County, John Foote. I've known John for a long time, and I guess I wasn't surprised to see that John is trying to fight back against an effort by state lawmakers to have lighter sentences for people who engage in various kinds of property crime, including ID theft. What was the legislature thinking, John? Do you know?
Well, I don't want to speak for them, but good afternoon, Lars.
Good afternoon.
I don't want to speak for them. I think there are people in Salem who are ideologically opposed to virtually any kind of prison sentence. Some of them are in leadership, although they won't admit to you that's how they feel. They have said things in certain settings and behaved in certain ways that I believe that is what some of them feel. And I think that drives a lot of this. I think, unfortunately, too often in politics now, ideology comes before facts.
Well, so this summer they passed a bill. So apparently a majority of them believe this. And they made changes to ballot measure 57, which was approved by the voters about 9 years ago, that allowed for tough sentences for repeat property thieves and drug offenders. So property crimes, of course, person crimes are murder, rape, robbery, assault, things where the person is affected. Property crimes are things where you steal stuff or you embezzle money or you engage in identity theft. The argument was made that we should somehow lighten up the punishment for those crimes. And apparently it found majority support in the House and the Senate and the governor's desk.
Yes, well, we live in a one-party state in Salem in terms of decision-making. There's really, on some issues, and right now on public safety, there's really no real debate about things. Things are decided in private, and then they're rolled out. And that's more or less what happened here. Testimony was very limited on the bill. This is not the first time they've tried to change Measure 57. And I'm talking mostly about the leadership in the House. They're entitled to their opinion. I'm not saying that. But unfortunately, if folks think that they're going to stop and just change this part of 57, they're wrong. There are people in that group who want to change, who want to eliminate Measure 57, who want to eliminate Measure 11.
Measure 11 is tougher punishment for person crimes, including child molesters and violent crimes, right?
That's right. And then they also want to destroy truth in sentencing, which is a fundamental value for victims and for prosecutors, because we want the sentence announced in court to be fundamentally what's served. And we have more and more mechanisms used to release people out the back door early, things called short-term transitional leave and earned time. And now they're starting work release in prisons. We had this stuff in the 1980s, and it was a disaster. Truth in sentencing is an important value so that victims and the public, when they hear the sentence announced, they know they're going to do most of it. And we've had that for about over 25 years, but it is being eroded. It was eroded in this bill.
John, tell me this. So you brought a lawsuit against the state.
Mm-hmm, I did.
What'd you sue on the basis of?
Well, back in 1994, the voters passed two measures. Measure 11, which we've already talked about, for violent crime, passed by over 60%. And then they also passed Measure 10 by a similar margin. And Measure 10 said that anytime the voters pass a sentencing law, can only be changed by the legislature with a two-thirds vote. That is still the law. It applies to Measure 57, which was passed by the voters by an overwhelming vote in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So if the legislature intends to change Measure 57, according to the Measure 10, which is part of the Oregon Constitution, they can't do it without a two-thirds vote. Well, they did that here.
What? Well, how far short?
57.
How far short did they fall of two-thirds on 57?
They need 40 in the House and 20 in the Senate. I think they had 33 in the House and 18 in the Senate.
So they were way short.
Yeah, especially in the House.
And so didn't their lawyers, I mean, they have lawyers for the legislature, didn't their lawyers say to them, yeah, you may have voted on this, but you didn't satisfy the constitutional requirement? Or are their lawyers not conversant with the Oregon Constitution? I'm just saying.
Well, you know, when you hire a lawyer, oftentimes you'll get the opinion you're looking for.
Or the one you paid for, right?
Yeah. Or the one you paid for. And the lawyers for the legislature, they're good people, but they wrote an opinion that said that that was okay. We disagree with it.
Hold on, John. What logic, if the voters back then passed Measure 10 and they put it in the Constitution, if you want to undo a sentencing law based on what the voters have voted for, Measure 57 or Measure 11, you have to do it by a two-thirds vote. By what legal logic did they figure out that falling way short of a two-thirds vote was still okay?
Well, again, I want to be very careful about speaking for them.
Yeah.
One of the problems, and I'll give you what I think they intended at the time, but one of the real fundamental problems here, Lars, is that the public has no idea that this happened. They really don't know that Measure 57 can only be changed by a two-thirds vote.
Mm-hmm.
They do not know that that was done without a two-thirds vote. There was no public discussion about it. It was just simply hidden. If you look at the bill, House Bill 3078, which amended Measure 57 fundamentally,
yeah,
they called it the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. It was all just cloaked in behind closed doors, and that's not healthy. And one of the purposes of our lawsuit is to pull this out in the open and make them explain in public why they think this is acceptable. And we get to say why we don't think it is. And that's why we think a court of law should hear this.
I'm talking to John Foote, who is the Clackamas County District Attorney. So he's the guy who brings charges, on the basis of the grand jury against people in Clackamas County. So if this happens, is it possible a judge can just look at this suit and say, it's pretty clear on its face that you're right, they failed to satisfy the two-thirds majority, so therefore we shouldn't enforce these laws because they violate the Oregon Constitution?
That's exactly what we're asking the court to do, and we'll see how that goes. It's hard for a judge, a trial-level judge particularly, to rule against the entire legislature, the political establishment in Salem.
Why? If it's right on the law, can't a trial judge probably look at this as an opportunity to get famous? I'm the one who actually, I ruled against the whole legislature because it says right there you got to have a two-thirds vote. They didn't have a two-thirds vote. He can even have his court clerk do the math and make sure that they didn't get to the two-thirds margin. And once they're done with that, just say, hey, legislature, you're out of order. And then leave it to the state, to Katie Brown and her bunch, to appeal it to the Oregon Court of Appeals and see if they can come up with a different calculation that works.
Well, that is the way our system of government is set up. And that's why we're doing this. But as you know, Lars, it's hard to stand up against authority. It is. And I'm doing it. And I'm not winning any popularity contests in Salem for it. And not everybody's kind of up to that. So we'll see how that goes. We think on the law we're dead right. But they must have an argument. And we'll see how it goes.
Well,
I just don't know how they get around it.
You know what, John? You may have too much faith in the legislature and its lawyers. Because, you know, I've got copies of legal opinions that were written for entities like the Portland Public Schools, in which their lawyers, I know how to read lawyer talk. I'm not a lawyer, but it effectively says, well, it's not legal for you to do this, but since we're your lawyers, will tell you that you can probably get away with it until somebody challenges you on it. And then at that point, you can decide if you want to fight about it or not, or if you just want to cave in and admit that they were right. It's kind of a brazen your way through until somebody calls you on it approach to life, which, you know, I mean, usually you don't see big institutions doing it. But if they're run by the, you know, the right bunch of crooks, they may just try and do it and say, hey, we'll just keep doing it till somebody calls us on it. Most of the time, people won't call us on it. We'll be fine. And if they call us on it, we can decide if we really want to take on that fight or not.
That can happen. Let me tell you what I've been told their logic is here.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
So this is what I've been told. We'll see if this is what they argue in court. But and this takes a little bit of an explanation. So Measure 57 was passed by over 60% of the voters in 2008. In 2009, the legislature announced that it didn't have enough money to implement 57. Setting aside for a moment whether that was a legitimate point or not, I contested it at the time. But so they suspended Measure 57 for a period of time, not very long. They made it express in all the legislative history that they were not revoking 57 or changing it, just simply suspending it for financial reasons, and they were going to re-implement it when they were in a little better shape, which is what they did. And the reason they did that was the voters had just voted it in, and they didn't want to be standing up saying they were overturning the vote of the people just after they had voted.
Of course not.
So now they're arguing in Salem that that decision in 2009 was, in fact, a revocation or change of Measure 57, and therefore they don't need a two-thirds vote anymore.
What? That's okay. That logic
that's
is—
That's what I've been told.
Yeah, that logic
and that's
is
why we
up.
Want to challenge it.
Good.
Because we think that's ridiculous.
Of course, the problem is that it, you know, the folks you're going to, the judges and the appeals judges and the Supreme Court, are all part of the establishment, aren't they?
Well, there are a lot of different kind of judges. Yeah. And
actually, John, since we've had Democrat governors for the last one-third of a century, and the Democrat governors appoint almost every single judge, almost no judge ever gets just elected by the people. We only have one kind of judge in this state. We have Democrat judges, don't we, John?
Well, in the metro area, you've got it exactly right. It's a little bit more balanced in more rural areas. You know, judges, this is a truism. Defense attorneys get appointed to judges and sometimes turn out to be very strong pro-public safety judges.
Yeah.
We've got some in this courthouse. And sometimes prosecutors get appointed and turn out to be not quite what we thought. So, you know, you never know how a judge is going to turn out. I know that we have a lot of good judges. My wife is a retired judge herself. She worked in Washington County for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. That all has to be played out. I hope we get a fair shake. That's what we're trying to do. We think we're right on the law, but we'll see. We just think, despite everything, it's very important that this conversation go on out in the open with a full and open debate in front of an independent party who isn't in Salem.
I hope you're right. John, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, sir.
You bet. John Foote, the Clackamas County District Attorney. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Get to your calls in a moment. Let me mention this to you. Do you think that if you're on a jury, either a civil or a criminal jury, should you be able to know the immigration status of the person who's involved in the case? In this case, should you know whether the person is an illegal alien or not? Well, the Washington State Supreme Court has just decided that no, you, the jury, do not have the right to know the illegal alien status of the person who's involved. Now, they say this comes from a case of a guy by the name of Alex Salas, who slipped off a ladder on a construction site about 15 years ago. And he got busted up pretty badly, and he sued the site's scaffolding subcontractor because the ladder did not meet code. Fine. A jury 9 years ago decided the company was negligent, but they didn't award Salas any money. And why? Because they knew he was illegally in the country. He shouldn't have been in the country. He had no right to be working a job in the country, and they decided not to give him any money. So a decade later, a King County jury has now awarded this illegal alien who was basically a visa overstay. His visa had run out years before, and he had no right to be working in America. They awarded him $2.6 million, which means his lawyers will get about $800,000, and he'll get $1.5 million. He shouldn't have even been here, and he's getting $1.5 million. And from this point forward, the Washington Supreme Court has ordered that juries may not know the immigration status of anybody in a criminal or a civil case. Can you imagine doing the Kate Steinle case without explaining down in San Francisco, the young woman who was murdered by the illegal? Imagine Washington State. You can't even tell the jury he's an illegal. Let's go to Linda. Hey, Linda, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And what's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I think I just heard Trump say that he and the world leaders agree that the IMF needed some reforms.
The International Monetary Fund, yeah.
Did you hear him say that?
I didn't hear him say that, but I wouldn't surprise me. I think it does need some reform, don't you?
Well, absolutely. Well, he I think it was the IMF he said that about. Otherwise, it was some major globalist, you know, elitist organization. And what struck me about that is, so the elites, when they hear that, they're going to go berserk. And I think the left has become the biggest supporter of the elites in this country, because when, you know, when Bernie Sanders would approve of renegotiating the IMF, and Bernie Sanders was opposed to the TPP, as is Trump, and Bernie Sanders would renegotiate NAFTA, as is Trump, and Bernie Sanders supporters think the pharmaceuticals make too much money. But when Trump proposes, no matter what Trump proposes, even if they happen to be the same ideas as Bernie Sanders, whatever he proposes, he's completely opposed by the left.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, for example, Barack Obama, as recently as a few years ago, was suggesting cutting the corporate tax rate to 28%. When Obama says it, it's gospel. When Trump says it, it's evil. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment, but I have a great opportunity right here. Lance Izumi joins me now, who's a senior fellow in education studies and a senior director of the Center for Education at the Pacific Research Institute, and the author most recently of The Corrupt Classroom. Lance, it's good to have you back on the program. How are you?
Yeah, thank you very much, Lars. It's always great to be on your show.
Well, thank you for that. While the rest of the world is focused on Hollywood and Washington, D.C., with allegations of, you know, sexual misdeeds of both celebrities and politicians, do you think that we should also be paying attention to some of the potential corruption that's going on in America's classrooms?
Absolutely, Lars. You know, I think that, you know, while those, you know, Hollywood celebrities and, you know, big wigs like Harvey Weinstein have been grabbing all the headlines over the last few months, you know, you have to just, you know, look down a little bit deeper, and you find out that many of those very same things that are going on in Hollywood are actually going on in America's public schools, and they're every bit as bad, and both on the crimes, but also even worse is really the enabling by the systems themselves that allow these individuals to commit their crimes and escape punishments for years and even decades.
So why is it that we're not seeing better policing in the classroom, since arguably the classrooms are, you know, involve some of the most vulnerable people in America? These are children. I mean, even if they're high school age children, they're more vulnerable than the general population. You'd think that America would do a good job of policing that with that kind of vulnerable population.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think that America's parents would feel that, you know, when they send their kids to the local neighborhood public school, that, you know, the one thing that they should be able to count on is that the safety of those kids will be looked after by the adults in the system. And then when you find out that the perpetrators of crimes, you know, many of them sexual in nature against kids, are not only committed by teachers and other staff at those schools, but also that administrators and higher-ups throughout the system are actually covering up for those perpetrators, that's when it just becomes absolutely sickening. And, you know, parents are rightfully wondering, you know, why am I paying my tax monies to support a system that is actually victimizing my children?
So why is it that we're not very good at policing those things? Because I got to tell you, Lance, on almost a weekly basis, almost every week, I will see a story from somewhere in America about another teacher, sometimes male, sometimes female, who is out taking sexual advantage of children. And it's as though It just happens on a very frequent basis. And for all the jokes about the Catholic Church and priests, they had their scandal, and they certainly had the involvement of the church in not going after the people, but instead of just sort of passing the trash down the line from one place to another. It seems the public schools in America are almost as bad, if not worse.
Well, you know, that's right. And I think you just have to look at, you know, the Portland schools in the very recent, you know, revelations by the Oregonian newspaper about the teacher, Mitchell Whitehurst, and his decades, allegedly, of sexual harassment against, you know, young girls. You know, to see, you know, A, you know, how, you know, terrible it was for those victims, those young girls, to have to go through, you know, this type of harassment from their own teacher. But also to see that over that 30-year period, as the Oregonian, you know, pointed out, you had school district officials, from the top lawyers to the human, you know, resources officials to principals, basically looking the other way and enabling this person to continue to do, you know, these evil acts, and not taking seriously the complaints and the charges and accusations made by the students who were the victims. And I think that what's even worse is that after the revelations, you know, became public, that the school district even then tried to keep a lid on it. And so the district officials, you know, paid $11,000 to hire an outside law firm to basically keep public information about this case from the public. And so that's the kind of thing that, you know, just absolutely destroys your people's confidence in this system. And you wonder, why is it that I am forced to keep my child in this system? Why don't I have an opportunity to send my child someplace else, you know, with the tax monies that I'm paying out?
Well, and in fact, why would the system want to protect somebody who is victimizing children? It's one thing, you know, if a school system says we want to protect the privacy of children and that sort of thing. But when you have staff members who are even suspected of being involved in sexually abusing children, schools are one of the institutions in America, in every single state, that are covered by mandatory reporting laws. That is, teachers, cops, social workers, nurses, doctors are all mandatory reporters. If they even suspect the sexual abuse of a child, they are required by law. In most places, it is it's a minor crime, but it's a crime for a teacher to fail to report that. And yet you have entire institutions that are actively covering up some of the abuse that may be happening under their own roof.
That's absolutely right. And that's one of the things that I think it's important to point out. I mean, you can have laws that state that, you know, school districts and schools and school officials are supposed to do certain things when, you know, certain allegations are made. But then it's always in the implementation of those laws. You know, how well, how good an investigation do those officials actually undertake? I mean, do they actually ask the students, you know, who are making the accusations about what really went on? I think that's one of the things that you find out in this Mitchell Whitehurst case. The Oregonian found that, you know, whether it's local or state officials, they really didn't delve into the they didn't really talk to the actual students who were making these accusations, so therefore they failed to connect the dots, and, you know, they ended up, you know, shelving these files, and, you know, nothing ever came out of them. And I think that's, you know, one of the lessons is that, you know, people say, well, why can't we have stronger laws? We should have stronger laws, but we also have to have officials who are going to be willing to carry out those laws in a very, you know, strict and, you know, strong way.
Well, so how much of this, the institution's unwillingness to go after this, how much of this has to do with the union representation of the teachers and the union rules that are promulgated ostensibly to protect the teachers who have done no wrong, but in some cases being used to actually protect the teachers that have done something wrong?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly the union bears some responsibility. You know, I mean, you look at, again, you know, going back to the Mitchell Whitehurst case, I mean, one of the things that the Portland Teachers Union has seemed to practice is, you know, the old mafia, you know,
Omerta,
you know, silence in the face of, you know, accusations. And so you hear virtually nothing from the Portland Teachers Union. And, you know, you look at cases or, you know, situations around the country, you know, Los Angeles, New York, places like that, you know, you have teachers who have been accused by very serious things, and who are basically still on the payroll but are put in rubber rooms where they collect their pay and are basically paid to do nothing but read the newspaper. And that's partly because of the union contracts that have been negotiated in those places. So, you know, I mean, like in Los Angeles, in the rubber rooms down there, up to 40% of the teachers who are collecting their salary for doing no work have been accused of some sexual crime or sexual harassment allegation.
Lance Izumi is the author most recently of The Corrupt Classroom. Lance, if people want to read what you've written for the Center for Education at the Pacific Research Institute, where can they find it?
Yeah, they can go to www.pacificresearch.org, and they can also get a copy of The Corrupt Classroom on Amazon.com.
Very good. Lance, it's always a pleasure. Thanks a lot for the work you do.
Thanks so much, Lars. Great to be on your show again.
You bet. Lance Izumi with us. Your calls and emails next at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Always like to start with naysayers, and John's on the line. John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Lars, that's John the electrician. Listen, Lars, before I get to my main point, I need to clarify something on when I called you on Friday on Veterans Day. I've been a 20-year naysayer, Lars, and on multiple occasions I had mentioned that I was U.S. Navy IBEW.
We're not going to relitigate this one.
You've never been able to bring yourself to do that, and finally did.
Hold on a second. John, you know what? I'm going to shut John down, and I will tell you, I usually put naysayers first. Here's John's complaint. He has called the show for once a week or every now and then for a long time. He finally mentions he was in the military. I say, thank you for your service. He says, that's the first time you've done that. It's the first time I've been aware of it. So John thinks that I can read minds. I can't. John may think I'm omniscient. I don't even think I'm omniscient. You know, all-knowing, all-seeing, all blah, blah, blah. My wife doesn't think I'm omniscient, and she's a pretty good judge of whether or not I'm omniscient or not. So because of that, John now wants to relitigate something that we already discussed last Friday, where I thanked him for his service, and he faulted me for that being the first time because it was the first time I was aware he'd been in the military. So, John, thank you for your service to the United States of America, and thank you for your call. Let's go to Bruce. Hey, Bruce, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars, thanks for the phone call. I was just giving you a call about the immigrant years back who fell on a ladder and hurt himself, and they didn't originally award him any money or anything.
The guy got $2.5 million, even though he wasn't working legally and shouldn't have been in the country at all. And now the Supreme Court of Washington says that juries in both civil and criminal cases aren't even allowed to know if somebody is an illegal alien or not.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to put my story out there is when I was 17, when you first get your license, you're not supposed to have people in your car. You're supposed to wait 6 months. Well, I was 17. Before that 6 months was up, I had a friend in the car, and we were sitting at a red light, and a car hit me at about 35 miles an hour at a stop.
Yeah.
And they told me that because I had somebody in my car that I was illegally on the road, and the accident was my fault for causing it. Mm. And I never got anything for that.
Did you ever talk to a lawyer about that? Because, look, the usual rule is if you get hit by somebody else, it's the person following who's at fault. It's always the person following at fault, even if you shouldn't have been on the road because you were only 16 and had a passenger in the car. Did they just, BS their way out of that? Or did you actually go to a lawyer and the lawyer said, you're right, or they're right, that because you had a passenger in your car, you're not entitled to any compensation?
We ended up doing a civil case, and I got something back from that. But for the insurance and everything like that, they said I was at fault, and the accident was my fault.
Your insurance company told you that?
Yeah, my insurance and their insurance.
Wow.
Because I wasn't supposed to be on the road.
Yeah, but if you'd been an illegal alien, they would have given you all the rights in the world, wouldn't they?
Yeah, or if I wouldn't have had insurance or something like that, something.
Yeah, just tell them you're an illegal alien, you don't have a driver's license, you don't have insurance. You're just about home free at that point. Plus, you have all the rights. Let's go to Craig. Hey, Craig, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for getting me on.
You bet. What's up?
I have an opinion and I have a question. My opinion is that schools should not be involved in law enforcement. You know, if a student or a teacher is involved in criminal activity or if they're a victim of a crime, the police are the ones that should investigate and deal with that, and not the school district or the school.
Well, I agree with the school district not dealing with it, but what happens when the school becomes aware that a student has been the victim of a crime or is suspected to be the victim of abuse? Shouldn't the school be required to report that?
Oh, absolutely, but that's what I mean. They should be required to report it to the police, and the police should deal with it, not the schools.
I agree with you.
What's going to happen.
I agree with you because a lot of the schools want to create a situation where they control the process because they don't want to get a black eye out of it, and instead they want to try and handle it, and that's not their expertise. Why would a school know anything about how to handle a child who's been raped or molested or abused or anything else? That's not their expertise.
Exactly. It becomes a political issue, and they just want to cover up their involvement, or they don't want to be involved. They don't want anybody to see them in it.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to Debbie. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Thank you, Lars. This is my first time calling, but I listen to you all the time. And
thank you.
I listened to you yesterday. About all the sexual harassment and, you know, women coming forward from years past and everything else. And, you know, I got to thinking to myself, what about men? Men get sexually harassed and they get raped, but they don't come forward because society would shoot them down and say they were lying, you know, because it's always the man's fault, never the woman's fault.
Well, you know, there are some physical reasons why that's probably the case, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but, you know, you only hear about the women being raped or, you know, abused, sexually abused. So
well,
there's men in, like, workplaces that get sexually harassed.
Well, they may be
sexually. But you never
sexually
hear about that.
Well, actually, you do. These days, you do hear about it. You hear about guys who, I mean, it doesn't happen all that often, and I'm sure you may be right that there are probably some guys who, if their boss is a good-looking lady and the boss says, I want you to sleep with me, the guys may actually be, you know, enough Clinton-esque that they may say, sure, boss, I'd be glad to do it. But there are guys who bring cases now from time to time. You just don't hear about them as frequently.
Yeah. Well, the reason I called is because I guess I just wanted everybody to be heard, you know, men included.
Well,
so
I think the invitation is there anytime men want to complain about it. And frankly, I would think that most guys, I don't know that I would think less of a friend of mine if he said, hey, I went to work at this job and the boss seemed to think that part of me working there was that she got to take me home to bed and, you know, and that I was her boy toy. I'd say, no, that's not what you should have to do to be able to maintain a job. That's kind of crazy. Let's go to let me go to Levi and Eugene. Levi, I might have to hold you over. Hey, Levi, what's on your mind today?
Just real quick, the lady before me said that men don't come forward and they don't get raped. But when I was young, when I was in my teens, I actually got raped by a fellow student. So, and I came forward with it. She was prosecuted and was actually turned into a sex offender. So.
And so she's a registered sex offender now.
Yes, she is a registered sex offender. I was incapacitated, I guess, and she took advantage of me. I was raped, and I took her to court over it.
Well, I appreciate you offering up that example, because like I said, it does happen, and people do, just not as frequently as the other way around. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and I want to mention this. Our quick poll or Twitter poll question is, a $1,000 fine enough punishment for former Governor John Kitzhaber, whose girlfriend ran a consulting business physically out of the governor's office? in which she took money from companies who wanted, and in addition to companies, private nonprofit entities, whatever you want to describe those as, who wanted to change the governor's point of view on various kinds of public policy issues. And now the governor has said that he admits that this happened, that he violated the law, but he had no idea that she was doing anything like this. Literally, his excuse is he did not personally understand that her work for 3E Strategies, which was not a big company, it was just her, basically, and various nonprofit organizations, was not directed at trying to shape or influence state policy, but rather to be an educator and a storyteller. Now, you want to know how much hogwash this is? There were big nonprofit organizations that wanted the state of Oregon to have a different point of view about coal and carbon and fuel and energy. And he seems to think that he can run this line of Bernie Sanders at us, BS, that I didn't know that these groups were trying to influence me, little old me, the governor. No, I thought she was just being a storyteller. That's why they wrote her somewhat over $200,000 in checks and gave her all that money so that she could be a good storyteller, not because she was the girlfriend of the state of Oregon. And if you buy that line of baloney, you know, call the show and tell me why. Our Twitter poll, found at LarsLarson.com on the website and at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, gravel, sand, and topsoil. Let the Dan Jones trucks put it where you want it and save your aching back. There is a story that involves Prosser, Washington that I want to mention because I've had calls from a number of you who have said, I live in a small town. My small town doesn't want anything to do with all this marijuana business. We think it's problematic. And I would agree with you, it is problematic. Now, I have voted against it when I've had the opportunity to. I understand the people of Oregon and Washington have voted for it, but I think they bought a pig in a poke. And here's what I mean by that. The federal government, and this was under Barack Obama, wrote a thing called the Cole Memo that said, you can legalize pot at the state level and we won't mess with you, even though it's still illegal under federal law, as long as you keep it inside your state, if you police it well enough that it's not being exported elsewhere. Well, the current estimate is that Oregon exports illegally $1 billion worth of pot a year. I don't know how much is coming out of Washington. They probably don't even want to add it up and figure it out. And they make a lot of tax money on it, too. Well, now officials in Prosser, Washington, are considering an emergency ordinance to ban new marijuana and production and processing for the next 6 months. The Tri-County Herald reports that Benton County commissioners are voting this week on that ordinance. Like the current retail ban, it would only affect new operators. Get this. This is not the most populous corner of Washington State. It would not apply to the 47 cannabis producers and 35 processors with physical addresses in Benton County, Washington. They say the ban would end after 6 months unless the county commission acts to extend it. Here's the problem. Benton County has struggled with the unexpected consequences of recreational pot for much of the year. Now, Washington voters, of course, passed it in 2012, but they didn't tell local communities, by the way, this could create some big problems for you, and it's your local law enforcement that's going to have to deal with it. Prosser, Washington, and Benton County are now trying to act to do something about this problem. To your calls now, let's go first to Brian in Kalama, Washington. Hey, Brian, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Have you heard anything lately about Fast and Furious?
Not a single word, and I would love, that's one of the things I'd love to have heard from Jeff Sessions, is that he was going to go back and look at the violations of the law committed by the Obama administration, sending guns into a Mexican drug war.
I tried to call the Justice Department to see if I could get some sort of a answer, and I couldn't get through, so I called Jamie Herrera's office, and the young lady that answered the phone thought I was asking her about a movie. So I had to explain the whole thing to her. And I'm supposed to get a response, but I don't know if I will. I just thought you might enjoy that. She asked me, wasn't that a movie?
Yeah, I get the joke, but isn't that sad that they don't know anything about that? You know, And the funny thing is, it involves one of the most serious crimes you can commit in America, which is a straw purchase of a firearm, meaning
You can't legally buy the gun, so you get somebody with a clean record to go in and buy it for you. In this case, they used Fast and Furious to allow the straw purchase of 2,500 firearms by Mexican nationals who then transported them illegally back across the border, where they were used illegally to murder several hundred Mexican nationals, and at least a few Americans were murdered with guns from Fast and Furious. And at the end of the day, nobody gets prosecuted for it. Boy, wouldn't you like to see Jeff Sessions go after that. Let's go to Joe. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Basically, I live in an HOA neighborhood in Clark County.
Yeah.
And my water bill is based on what the city commissioners of the city of Vancouver charge me for. So basically, if I lived in the city, it would be $2.11 per 100 cubic feet. Out in the county, it's $3.15.
Why is it so much more?
They said, well, the excuse they give is lame, but basically my water bill was $225 for the month of August, and I don't even water the back lawn.
No, but stop. Why is it higher in the county than in the city?
They charge me more, $1 per 100 cubic feet.
Did they tell you why it's an extra dollar per 100 cubic feet?
I went as far as the county commissioners, and he said I'm subsidizing their infrastructure.
Yeah, you probably are to some extent, because you if you live in a rural area, you know, when you lay pipes down, and I'm not necessarily defending this, but if I had to try and see the logic in it, if you're inside a city, when you lay down 12-inch water pipe to supply houses, you've got a customer every 50 feet or 60 feet on all those house lots. When you get out to the county, you might have a customer every 300 feet. Or a customer every 500 feet, or even a couple of thousand feet, depending on how far apart the properties are. So you're going to have to lay a whole lot more pipe for every customer that's there than you do in a city. So I could see the cost being a bit higher in the county than in the city.
Well, I was talking with some of the developers out here that are building homes north of me, and they're paying outrageous building fees.
I'm sure they are. They're probably getting socked for system development charges and everything else, which is...
You got it.
I guess, you know... Has it ever occurred to you that, I'll tell you something that never comes up in this conversation about water. Where do you buy your electricity?
From the county, basically.
Right, from the county, from the PUD. Where do you buy your natural gas?
Actually, it comes from Oregon.
Well, but it comes from a private company, right?
True.
Okay. And in some cases, people buy their electricity from a private company. But when it comes to water, I don't know of a single private water supply system in America. They're almost all run by the government. Now, I have a negative attitude about things run by the government. They tend to be more expensive, they tend to be inefficient, and they tend to be not as well run as a private enterprise would be. Is there any reason we couldn't buy water from the same kind of company that we buy natural gas from?
Oh, I agree. My train of thought is, why can't I vote for these guys? You know, if I don't like the way they're doing their job, I should be able to vote them out of office.
Well, but you are in Clark County, right?
I am, but I cannot vote for the city commissioners.
No, but you can vote for the county commissioners who negotiate the rate that you pay in the county, right?
True.
And all I'm saying is, whoever negotiated that rate, I would assume that because you're in the county, that the rate was negotiated between the city, which has the water system, and the county, which doesn't. Right? Because it's a City of Vancouver water system that is selling water to county residents, right?
That's true. Very true.
And here's the other piece of it. I mean, I don't like my water bill either. But if you're the city and you're going to negotiate a rate to sell to people who don't live in the city, you're going to try and get all the dollars you can, because that'll help keep the city rates lower, right? Because your first allegiance should be to your constituents, right?
Sure. I agree.
So
it's like I'm just north of 94th and Patton Parkway, and to me, this is city.
And by the way, the other advantage to going to a private entity to buy water from, have you ever heard of prevailing wage?
Yes.
Private companies don't pay it. Government agencies do. So every time they put a pipe in the ground, the labor to put the pipe in the ground costs you a lot more.
Yeah, like $48 an hour.
It can cost $48 an hour. Imagine that, over $100,000 a year just to do that kind of work. And if it was being done for a private company, it would be considerably less. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And is $1,000 fine enough punishment for John Kitzhaber's crimes? I'd love to know somebody who thinks that's plenty. I certainly don't think it's plenty. Let's go to Kyle. Hey, Kyle, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, not much. Just giving you a call in, Lars. First time caller here.
Thank you.
I just with the last caller and what you guys were talking about with the water and the plumbing.
Yeah.
And I do a little bit. I pipe fit for a private company out here in Portland. We do radon mitigation.
Yeah.
We are private, and we still get paid prevailing wage. You know, and if that were to ever be taken away from my company, I don't think that this would be a job that I would be seeking.
Why do you get prevailing wage?
Well, when I do work radon mitigation, and I do work in federal funded schools.
Yeah. So you're getting it because you're on a public project. Right?
Correct. That is very,
Do you mind if I test something here? So what's your rate when you're working on one of those projects per hour?
Well, that depends on what we're doing.
Pick a task. If you're putting pipes together,
pipe fitting is 70 to anywhere from 70 to $79 an hour.
So almost $160,000 a year. At that rate. Okay, pretty good pay for putting pipes together. If you were doing, have you ever done any private projects that are not prevailing wage?
Oh, yeah, I do residential every day.
And how much does that pay per hour for the same kind of work?
My base rate comes anywhere from $16 an hour, and on up to, we make somewhere around 18 to 20,
Okay, so 20 bucks an hour if you're doing it for the happy homeowner. Four times as much money if you're doing it for the government, almost 80 bucks an hour. Can you tell me any reason why the taxpayer should get soaked for that much money when the work you're doing is worth $20 an hour, but you're charging 79, almost 80 bucks an hour?
I actually have no good answer for that. I was just making it a very valid point that there are private companies out there that do still get the prevailing wage of the federal funded, even though we are not a government.
No, hold on. You know that when maybe you're missing something. Prevailing wage gets paid to private companies when they work on a public project. So if Nike calls you up and says, we need a road built on our world campus, and we want it built to the same standards as the city around us, but it's a private road, that's the rate they pay. If the city of Beaverton, right next to the Nike World Campus, says, we need a road built by the same company to the same standards, you get a prevailing wage. And you get that because you're working on a government project. And I guess I'm wondering, if you had to explain to your tax-paying friends why it's worth $79 an hour for work that's done on a public project, but it's only $20 an hour if you're working on a project for a private homeowner, Why such a big difference?
Well, that's because isn't it true that when that building or establishment, let's say a school is contracted, they contract a certain amount for anybody who comes in and touches or does work on that specific infrastructure, you are willing, you're paid the prevailing wage. Then that goes for anybody who
touches. It's a law that says we're doing it for the government that we're going to soak you for four times as much money. Now, I'm just wondering why. I mean, if you heard...
It's not a very good law, but it is something that is there. And for us that, we aren't necessarily...
You think it's good because it puts money in your pocket, right?
Kyle, that's what I'm saying.
You like it because it puts money in your pocket, right?
Oh, yeah. A citizen, yes, I would say, I don't have to work for the government, but I still get paid a good chunk of money, occasionally. And I'm not saying I work prevailing wage.
I get that. Let me try something on you. What's gas cost? $3.50 a gallon?
Roughly. On where you're at, $3.20.
What if every time a police car pulled into a gas station, they got charged $16 a gallon?
Okay.
Would you think that would make sense? It's good for the gas pump.
That wouldn't be necessarily
And now we're going to a different category because
it's just saying that when the gas stations
they're already provided with their own gas.
I know they have their own. But if a police car is short of gas and they have to pull in and buy some gas, because it's a government vehicle, should we charge four times as much for the gas that goes in there? You know, to make a fatter living for the gas station owner.
Well, essentially, you could say yes, but then I would say no because it would reap so on. It would take away from, you know,
the taxpayers.
Give and take. So it's, let's say, like, if you go ahead and say there is.
We're going to be up against the clock here in a second. But.
All right. Well, probably not enough time for me to really get in what I would like to say. You know.
Well, maybe we'll do it First Amendment Friday. Kyle, thanks very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.